What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Sharon Hart Green, author of the wonderful debut novel, Come Back For Me. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shin Shinim, Chen Denachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy holiday of Chanukah. We talk about this enjoyable Jewish festival quite a lot and always emphasize its importance, commemorating the victory of the few over the many, the weak over the strong, and especially those who wanted to practice their faith over those who wished to stop them from doing so. Chanukah at heart is about fighting for religious freedom, a great and abiding theme that has resonance for every religion and culture in every era. During this holiday, we also rhapsodize about latkes, Jewish potato and onion pancakes, the most delicious food ever created, and quite possibly the least healthy, or sufganiyot, the Israeli version of a jelly donut, also very tasty and magnificently and unapologetically anti-nutritional. This is a wonderful time of year for parties, Hanukkah menorah lighting, eating, and gift-giving, a secondary but now quite standard part of this festival of lights. But there's one aspect of Hanukkah we tend not to talk about much. That is the game of dreidel, sivivon, the traditional contest of spinning tops that we are supposed to engage in on this eight-day holiday. Dreidel is actually a Yiddish word, which comes from the word drei, which means to go round and round like a spinning top. That word is used in other contexts. We say a confused person is a dreikop, and that the rabbi who goes on too long in his or her elliptically extended sermon dreis on and on. The Hebrew word is sevivon, kind of the same idea from the word savav, to go around or encircle. The dreidel or sevivon itself has a point on the bottom and four flattened sides, each embossed with a single Hebrew letter. In Israel, those letters are Nun, Gimel, He, and Pe, which stand for the words Nes Gadol Haya Po, a great miracle happened here. Outside of Israel, here in the rest of the world, the diaspora, the letters stand for Nes Gadol Haya Sham, a great miracle happened there, you know, in Israel. Both acronyms are supposed to allude to the miraculous victory of the Maccabees over the great Syrian Greek armies of Antiochus IV Epiphanes in the 2nd century BCE. And when your dreidel lands, the letter showing on top dictates what you do. It's a kind of unskilled gambling game, like a simplified version of throwing dice. There's a pool of chocolate coins or nuts in the middle. When the dreidel lands with the gimel showing, you take the whole pot. He means take half the pot, nun means you don't do anything, and shin means you put in a few coins or nuts. Rabbis have gone to great length to prove this little game has mighty historical associations. In order to suppress resistance, the Syrian Greeks prohibited Jews from learning Torah. So, one 19th century rabbi maintained the Jews played dreidel to fool the Greeks by teaching the lesson of Hanukkah in subterfuge. And if they were caught studying Torah, which was outlawed, they could claim they were merely playing dreidel. Other rabbis calculated elaborate word plays and gematriot, Talmudic numerological explanations based on the fact that every Hebrew letter has a numerical equivalent. They came up with these for the letters Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin. For example, in Gematria, they equal 358, which is also the numerical equivalent of the Mashiach word, or Messiah. Therefore, this dreidel must be a messianic game. A later explanation says the letters Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin are supposed to represent the four kingdoms that tried to destroy us in ancient times. Nun was King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, who burned the first temple. He was Haman, who attempted genocide of the Jews of Persia in the Book of Esther. Gimel stands for Greece, home culture of Antiochus, who tried to stop us practicing Judaism in the time of the Maccabees. And Shin, well, that's Seir, kind of the same letter in Hebrew, a euphemism for Rome, which destroyed the Second Temple. Well, actually, the Game of Dreidel had nothing to do with Hanukkah originally, and it didn't start at the time of the Maccabees, nor did we Jews even invent it. It's been played by a variety of peoples in various languages for about 500 years. In England and Ireland, there was a game called Teetotum that's especially popular, or was so, at Christmas. The name comes from the Latin word totum, meaning all. The game is first mentioned around the year 1500 in some texts. By 1801, the four letters on the side of the top clearly represented four specific words in English. T, take all, H, take half, P, put down, and N, nothing. Our Jewish Eastern European game of dreidel, including the letters Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin, is actually based on the German equivalent of this English-Irish totem game. N equals nicht, nothing. Gimel equals ganz, all. He is halb, take half. And S, well, that's stell ein, put in. The dreidel game represents an irony of Jewish history. To celebrate the holiday of Hanukkah, our great victory over cultural assimilation, we play dreidel, which is itself an excellent example of cultural assimilation. Of course, there's a world of difference between imitating non-Jewish games and worshiping idols, but you get the idea. It's ironic. I have always thought that Hanukkah celebrates the victory of Jews 2,200 years ago over aspects of culture that are now finally winning over us, the Maccabees' descendants, in today's American Judaism. They fought for religious practice and Jewish learning against the Greek culture's emphasis on athletics and theatrical presentations of drama, music, and comedy. Today, most American Jews seem to prefer athletics and theatrical presentations over religious practice and learning. In any case, the main problem with dreidel is that the game is kind of simplistic. You know, dumb. Somebody spins a gimel, there's nothing left in the pot, and you keep spinning for a long time until that person finally loses enough of his or her winnings to make the game more interesting for everybody else, or until everyone loses interest. We've modified the game in my house, so you have to ante up some of your precious chocolate coins every spin, which speeds the game up and definitely increases competition. Now, if I could just convince everyone to play for, you know, actual money, like $100 a spin, we'd really have something. Well, anyway, to play us in this morning, here's a Hanukkah tune about dreidel from the Levy's album Hanukkah Rocks. That was recorded in 8 days, a decade or so ago.
Times you just might take the pot, so let's do this once again. Kitchen table dreidelin, Nun, Gimel, Hey, Shin, pick it up, give it a spin.
That was the Levy's Dreidel Anthem, Nun Gimel Hei Shin, for Hanukkah. Our guest this morning, Sharon Hart Green, has written a marvelous debut novel, thoughtful, challenging, literary, and moving. Find out what it's about when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Sharon Hart Green, whose debut novel is Come Back For Me, released earlier this year. Remarkable story, powerful, rich, and complex, about trauma, loss, and redemption and love. Sharon Green received her PhD in Judaic Studies from Brandeis, has taught Hebrew and Yiddish literature at the University of Toronto, and she's an expert on both. We're delighted to welcome her to Too Jewish. Good morning and welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
So it's one thing to be a professor of great Hebrew and Yiddish authors. It's another to write your own novel. Tell us how that transpired.
I had been teaching for many years and really had not written fiction until, I guess it was around 10 years ago. I felt this need to express myself creatively. I had always been involved in the arts from the very youngest age. I was always drawing. I was an actress for a while. I played music. I did write quite a bit while I was in high school, and I was encouraged to do so by my English teachers. But I had never really pursued writing in any kind of professional sense. But I think somehow after teaching Hebrew and Yiddish literature for so many years and having written, you know, articles and a few books, I felt that I wasn't entirely satisfied. I somehow was driven to write something of my own. And I just started writing one day, and it kind of poured out of me.
You know, not being driven to write is a difficult formula for success in writing. As you know, having studied authors, it's a can be a painful and definitely a disciplined process. And yet, the book reads beautifully and it flows. How long did it actually take you to write?
Well, whenever someone asks me that, I always say, don't ask, because it really did take a long time. I probably started writing it about 10 years ago. In little bits here and there, but I really did not fully engage in the writing process until I took a break from teaching. Somehow while I was teaching, I just found it very difficult to really get into the novel. And it went through so many revisions. I really restructured it twice or three times in the process until I got it just right. I knew that it wasn't quite ready, and I kept rewriting and rewriting and polishing until it was ready. And then I, you know, got an agent. It was acquired by a publisher. And the rest is history.
We will talk much more with Sharon Hart Green. Her book is called Come Back For Me. It's an extraordinary novel. Hear more about it and her own influences when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohan Foundation Award, please go to CohanAward.com, CohanAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohanAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18 at gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18 at gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. While we Jews celebrate Hanukkah, Christmas songs, shows, and publicity predominate in our society. The best song about this ongoing conflict, challenge really, came from the spectacular duo of Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart a few years back. It's called Can I Interest You in Hanukkah?
Can I interest you in Hanukkah? Maybe something in a festival of lights. It's a sensible alternative to Christmas, and it lasts for 7 for you, 8 nine.
Hanukkah, huh? I've never really thought about it.
Well, you could do worse.
Is it merry?
It's kind of merry.
Is it cheery?
It's got some cheer.
Is it jolly?
Look, I wouldn't know from jolly, but it's not my least unfavorite time of year.
When's it start?
On the 25th.
Of December?
Kislev.
Which is when exactly?
I will check.
Are there presents?
Yes, indeed, 8 days of presents, which means one nice one, then a week of trek.
Does Hanukkah commemorate events profound and holy? A king who came to save the world?
No oil that burned quite slowly.
Well, it sounds fantastic.
There's more. We have latkes.
What are they?
Potato pancakes. We have dreidels.
What are they?
Wooden tops. We have candles.
What are they?
They are candles. And when we light them, oh, the fun, it never stops. What do you say, Stephen? You want to give Hanukkah a try?
I'm trying to see me as a Jew. I'm trying even harder. But I believe in Jesus Christ, so it's a real non-starter.
I can't interest you in Hanukkah. Just a little bit.
No thanks, I'll pass. I'll keep Jesus, you keep your potato pancakes. But I hope that you enjoy them on behalf of all the Goyim.
Be sure to tell the pontiff, my people say good yontif.
That's exactly what I'll do.
Happy holidays, you too.
That was Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart singing the quite wonderful Can I Interest You in Hanukkah for the so-called holiday season going on now for Jews. Today's the fifth day of Hanukkah, tonight the sixth night. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Happy Hanukkah.
And to you.
We started talking last week about anti-Semitic literature, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and its kind of continued influence. We talked about Japan, where it's still a bestseller because they think that the Jews are smart and control the world. And by and large, that means something positive there in a weird way, even though it's an obvious fake, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That is not true for most anti-Semitic literature. It doesn't turn out that way.
Right. Well, one of the oldest forms of anti-Semitic literature is actually oral literature, the blood libel, which originated sometime around the time of the Crusades and spread from England all over the world, basically, wherever there were Jewish communities or wherever people had even heard of Jews or seen an occasional Jewish merchant, this story that was an obvious fabrication, that Jews used the blood of Christian children to make Passover matzah, spread and was widely believed, particularly by ignorant people who know nothing about the Jewish dietary laws and the Jewish aversion to blood in any form, and if there's a blood spot in an egg, you have to throw out the egg, you can't use it, et cetera, et cetera. That was basically oral literature. Written literature, well, there was no printing press until the 15th century, so written literature comes later, and probably the best-known example of powerful anti-Semitic written literature is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But I just yesterday saw on Facebook a shocking piece written by a purported scholar that said the whole story of Jews in Egypt is a lie. That one of the things he used to prove his point was that the Bible makes no reference to the pyramids, and nobody who's ever been in Egypt could possibly talk about Egypt without referring to the pyramids. But then he went on to say that the Jews have ruined many civilizations in many countries, like Germany and America and whatever. And his concluding lines were, Jews are liars. They always have been. They always will be. So just like a red flag for your listeners, you could substitute any group's identifier in a sentence like that and talk about, I don't know, Muslims or Arabs or African Americans or the LGBT community or whatever. And if you say about an entire group, they are liars, they always have been, they always will be, chances are it's not a scholarly article.
You think?
Chances are it's racist BS. And I was shocked, as were many of his friends, that my friend, who's a moderate Christian Arab, grew up in Jordan, now lives in Canada, whatever, posted this thing, in which also the scholarship was sloppy. There were just a lot of factual errors, besides these things that were obviously opinion as opposed to fact. And the basis of the argument was that Mitzrayim was mistranslated by Greeks who were allies of the Jews as being Egypt, when in fact it was a little province of the Arabian Peninsula down near modern Yemen, and that clearly the Jews had never been in Egypt at all, and this was a slander against a great ancient culture and whatever. So this guy is probably on the payroll of the Egyptian Ministry of Education or Propaganda or whatever, but has an American-sounding name, or at least a North American-sounding name. Could be Canadian. But it's just further proof that anti-Semitic literature is far from being a thing of the past, and you have to read stuff with your eyes wide open. The fact that it appears on the internet doesn't make it true.
That is perhaps the truest thing anybody has said in 2017. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Tamir Shakuri and Chen Dinachi, who are here representing the Weintraub Israel Center and Israel in our community. Boker Tov, Chag Chanukah Sameach, Chag Orim Sameach.
Boker Tov.
So Chanukah is here. We're in the midst of it. It's the one holiday you can be in the midst of for a long period of time. Tell us what Chanukah is like for you guys in Israel.
So, okay, first of all, sorry, my throat hurts a little.
A winter cold, it's okay.
So Chanukah in Israel is, I mean, first of all, it's like we don't have any holiday to compete with, if you know what I'm saying. So it's very like...
So no Christmas carols. And
you said it. I only said a holiday.
No, I remember when I lived in Israel and it was the middle of December and I thought something's wrong. And I realized I hadn't heard any carols like December 20th or something.
So, yeah, and we also, we don't have donuts all year round. We only have donuts on Hanukkah. You cannot find donuts if it's not Hanukkah. So when Hanukkah comes, you eat donuts. Like, there is literally no tomorrow, because there might be a tomorrow, but it's not going to have donuts.
So Sufganiyot, big time, major, major improvement.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. At the end of Hanukkah, if you don't look like a Sufganiyah, you failed. And every night you have people over, and like either you have people over or you go over to like light a candle and you sing and you like have a little dinner. And it's really fun. It's really special. It's a time where you get to see a lot of your friends, a lot of your family, but like everyone together. Like if it's your family, friends going to light a candle at someone's house, like it's a very happy environment. Also the Sufganiyot, like you can't be sad when they're around. So yeah, I love it. It's one of my favorite holidays.
Thank you, Chayin. And Tamir, tell us about Hanukkah for you guys.
In my family, Hanukkah is a very, we're all sitting together in front of the menorah and we light it up, the Hanukkiah, sorry, every day.
So do you use an oil or a candle menorah? Because I know in Israel, it's not uncommon, particularly in Jerusalem, you see the oil menorahs, oil Hanukkiyot, in glass boxes outside sometimes. You know, they're very clearly displayed.
Actually, we use a candle Hanukkiah.
Uh-huh.
And in my family, every day we gather around and we light the candle that is the day that we're supposed to. And you just can't miss it. If I go with my friends, I have to come back in time in order to light the candle with all of my family. And for me, it's special because I have two older sisters that are not around so much. So I know in Hanukkah I'm going to see them every day for the candles. There's no way to miss it. It's just like a rule in my family. And if people join us, then it's awesome. If we go somewhere, then it's also great. But we're all as a family every day in Hanukkah. And I feel like it's a great holiday because it makes us all come together and light the candles together and sing songs and eat Levivot and Sufganiyot, and it's just a great holiday. It's one of my favorites, too.
My favorite, too. And by the way, I had to tell both of you guys that there's no cholesterol, there's no fat, and anything you eat on Hanukkah for those 8 days, decreed by God. So yep. I'll give you the official notice. Thanks so much, guys. Hanukkah Sameh, Chagorim Sameh.
Thank you, you too.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A young Jewish man excitedly tells his mother he's fallen in love and is going to get married. He says, "Just for fun, Ma, I'm bringing over three women. You try to guess which one I'm going to marry." Mother nods, "Okay." The next day, son brings three beautiful women into the house, sits them down on the couch. They chat for a while with his mom. He then says, "Okay, Ma, guess which one I'm going to marry." She replies immediately, "The redhead in the middle." "It's amazing, Ma," her son says. "You're right. How did you know?" "Her? Her I don't like." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash begins with the climax of the great Joseph story that fills the last sections of Genesis. Joseph is the powerful ruler of Egypt, richest country of the ancient world. His miraculous ascent from slavery and prison to the heights of political power is the stuff dreams are made of. He is the master of all he surveys, subservient only to a pharaoh who trusts him completely. Joseph is handsome, rich, hugely powerful, with a wife and two fine sons, completely assimilated into Egypt's elegant culture, and still comparatively young. The world sits at his manicured feet. But wait, there's more. For into this idyllic scene blunder Joseph's early tormentors, the very half-brothers who taunted him and beat him. These are the conniving thugs who stripped him and tossed him into a pit in the earth, and then sat down to eat lunch, debating in his hearing whether to kill him or just abandon him to thirst and starvation, and then ultimately sold him into slavery in a foreign land instead. Now, 20 years later or so, he has had the opportunity to return the favor. to exact at least a psychological vengeance on these half-brothers. After a sequence of twists and turns, Joseph has manipulated them into a state of confusion and terror, unmanned these arrogant, unruly rural ruffians into fearful submission. Joseph has had his dish of revenge served cold and seems to be enjoying it. But then something changes in Joseph. Perhaps he simply tires of psychologically torturing his half-brothers. Perhaps it's that he has finally seen his full brother Benjamin again, the only living reminder of his dead mother Rachel. Perhaps it is that the fullest measure of revenge is magnanimity. Perhaps it's simply that Joseph's exceptional ability to act pragmatically exerts itself. He must end the cat-and-mouse game one way or another. Or perhaps it is the stirring confessional speech his powerful half-brother Judah delivers that brings Joseph to a new place. But near the beginning of Vayigash, this week's portion, and the dramatic high point of the story, Joseph chooses to reunite with his family. He sends out the advisors, counselors, and courtiers. He cries out in a voice loud enough to be heard throughout the palace. He tells the brothers that he is Joseph. Weeping, he embraces his brother Benjamin, asking, "Is my father still alive?" One can imagine the shock of that moment even now, 3,600 years after the events. The brothers may have had an inkling that he was indeed Joseph. It's implied in the story, but the full revelation must have been stunning nonetheless. Their worst fears are realized. They have been and are now completely in the power of a despised half-brother they comprehensively wronged. What now? Joseph moves immediately to reassure them and to relieve their fears, while he gently reminds them that he is the authority now. Everyone will move down to Egypt and live in the land he provides. Jacob comes down to Egypt to his father. The family is reassembled, but in a different configuration. For the unquestioned new patriarch is Joseph, and the great story will continue in a new land and in a new direction. There's something about the Joseph story that compels us to examine our assumptions about how things work in the world. Unpredictable things occur. What we expect is often not what happens. Fate may play a role. God plays a role. And in the best of circumstances, and with God's help, our own actions, like Joseph's, may begin from a base motivation and yet rise to a level of magnanimity and grace. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Sharon Hart Green, will explain how her outstanding debut novel, Come Back For Me, originated and why it took 10 years to write. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An Argentinian judge ordered the arrest last week of the country's former president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, for covering up Iranian involvement in the 1994 bombing at the Buenos Aires Amia Jewish Center that left 85 people dead. Judge Claudio Bonadio accused Kirchner of the crime of treason. He asked lawmakers to remove the immunity from prosecution she has as a senator.
Prosecutor Eduardo Taino said the judge also ordered the arrest of former Kirchner aide Carlos Zani and activist Luis Delia on the same charges. Former Foreign Minister Hector Timmerman was ordered held under house arrest because of health issues. The former President Kirchner is accused of signing a deal with Tehran that allowed Iranian officials suspected of ordering the attack on the Jewish center to be interviewed by Argentine magistrates in Tehran rather than Buenos Aires. She previously has called the case an absurdity. In November, an investigation by the country's border police agency concluded that Alberto Nisman, who led the probe into the Buenos Aires terror attack on the Jewish center, was murdered just 4 days after he formally accused then-President Kirchner of covering up the role of former Iranian officials in the attack. Prosecutors subsequently ordered a murder investigation into Alberto Nisman's death. Previously, it had been ruled a suicide. Nisman, 51 years old, was found dead January 18, 2015, with a bullet in his right temple. A .22-caliber pistol was found next to him. The Amiya Jewish Center bombing case is the most serious one against Kirchner, who is facing trial in several other cases involving corruption and money laundering from her years as president. Last week, the court rejected an appeal by Kirchner to dismiss the money laundering charges. The 64-year-old Kirchner also faces charges on bribery and criminal conspiracy in the Hotessur case, named after a Kirchner family hotel business in Patagonia, the suspected source of the allegedly laundered funds. Kirchner had 2 4-year terms in office as president. She's due to take her seat in the Senate next week after winning an election in October. That political comeback granted her immunity from imprisonment in these various cases. The Senate now has to vote to lift her immunity at the judge's request. That requires a 2/3 majority. It's not clear that that will happen. Kirchner's leftist alliance in the Senate has 32 seats, but only about a dozen of those senators are her allies. The center-right Cambiemos alliance of President Mauricio Macri has 25 seats in the Senate. Several prominent members of the former Argentine government have been detained on corruption charges in recent weeks, including her ex-public works minister Julio De Vito and Amado Bubo, Kirchner's vice president. But her involvement in covering up Iran's role in the Amiya Jewish Center terror bombing 23 years ago is the most serious of all the charges she now faces. We hope justice will finally be done. In depressing news about a situation that shouldn't happen, congregants at a conservative synagogue in suburban Boston are suing the local Chabad, alleging its members infiltrated their leadership to take control of the synagogue and seize its assets. The case was filed by members of Temple Adat Sharon in Sharon, Massachusetts, and it accuses Chabad of Sharon of encouraging its members and actively participating to take over Adat Sharon's board and to transfer Adat Sharon's assets to Chabad. The plaintiffs claim the local Chabad is experiencing serious financial troubles and seeks to convert the conservative congregation's assets to solve its financial situation. Chabad of Sharon has denied the allegations. According to the lawsuit, 9 of the conservative synagogue's board members and officials were elected illegitimately in April 2015 at a membership meeting. The plaintiffs say the members are affiliated with Chabad and ran for office for the purpose of depriving Adat Sharon's true members of their voting rights and transferring control and assets to Chabad. Among the officers the lawsuit says are illegitimate are Chabad Rabbi Chaim Wallaceau, who was elected vice president, his daughter Chana Minkowitz, who was elected secretary treasurer, and his son-in-law, Rabbi Naftali Minkowitz, who was elected president. Wallaceau resigned as head of the congregation when the lawsuit was filed. The lawsuit also says that Dr. Jordan Leff was elected illegitimately as president in 2008, and in a November 2014 membership meeting, he and another synagogue officer announced that the purported board of directors had voted to donate Adat Sharon, its building, and all its assets to Chabad. The plaintiffs value the synagogue at $1 million, at least its building. They are asking the court to order a membership meeting and repayment of their legal fees by Chabad and to prevent the defendants from giving away Adat Sharon's assets. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning,
Professor Sharon Hart Green is the author of the book Come Back For Me, a wonderful novel, complicated, rich, multi-layered. It's her debut novel after a lot of nonfiction writing and academic writing. You wrote a significant study of Agnon, the great Hebrew novelist, who has a beautiful elliptical, almost Talmudic, Midrashic style.
Yes.
Did he influence you in your own writing? Your writing doesn't read like Agnon, but I wonder.
No, it really doesn't. I think I was influenced by Agnon in a certain way because he was one of the first Hebrew writers that I read. And, he was the one who inspired me from the very beginning to pursue my study of Jewish literature. So I think in some ways I was influenced by him because of the precision of his language and just the magical quality of his storytelling, even though stylistically I know that my writing is not like his, but I admire his writing so greatly that I still think he is the master of Hebrew literature.
Who did influence your style?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I read very widely, and I read a lot of 19th century English literature, Dickens, Jane Austen, and then I read a lot of Jewish literature and contemporary American literature. I love Cynthia Ozick, Saul Bellow, but I can't say that I write anything like them as either. I think I just somehow developed my own style. I think once I found my voice, it just kind of flowed. But I would say that the work of Isaac Bashevis Singer, perhaps some have compared my writing to.
No, as my grandparents would say, you don't write dirty enough for Isaac Bashevis.
That's true. No, my book is very clean. In fact, it's funny because I'm getting a lot of interest from schools. High schools, colleges, it seems that, because there isn't anything salacious in it, it's being viewed as something that would, even though it's written for adults, it could be easily written for, or at least read by young adults as well.
Absolutely true. What led you to this particular story?
Well, again, that's hard to answer because I didn't really plan it out. I allowed it to just emerge. On the other hand, I was always fascinated by survivors. I intentionally did not want to write about the war itself. And as you recall...
Well, by war, you mean, of course, the Holocaust and World War II.
The Holocaust. I did not feel that I, as someone born, quite a few years after the war was over, that I had the right somehow to imagine what it was really like. Very little of the novel takes place during the war. It's probably 10 pages. But really, the novel is focused on the post-war period. And so I think that I was drawn to writing about that period, but I did not want to write about the war itself. But yet, even though I'm not a child of survivors, I was surrounded by survivors when I was growing up. I grew up in Toronto, and I happened to live on a street where there are a lot of survivors. And in fact, my very best friend, and this was a friend whose house I was in all the time, was a child of survivors. And it was a very unusual home. The father had lost most of his family in the war. The mother was actually a German woman who converted to Judaism. And so I think just being in their home all the time and absorbing the atmosphere had a very deep influence on me.
You do write about the aftermath of the Six-Day War, and the book came out, this year, the 50th anniversary of that. Was that accidental?
Yes.
The anniversary connection with the release of the book?
I hadn't really thought of that. I just think of the Six-Day War as being so pivotal in the history of modern Israel. So I hadn't really planned it because I didn't know when it was going to actually come out. So I think that's kind of serendipitous, you could say.
Yes, we call it Beshert, maybe.
Yes, Beshert, of course. and Beshert Kite does play a role in the novel,
It does indeed. One thing I didn't ask you about is which Yiddish authors do you think influenced you? Because this has, although it's a, you know, a very lucid and new world kind of story, I don't know, there's something, whether it's Pesheva Singer or, I don't know, there's something, there's somebody else there, I'm not sure whom.
Yeah, I know I do read a lot of Yiddish literature as well, and I taught it for many years. I really started by teaching Yiddish literature, and then I shifted into Hebrew literature, which was more of my specialty anyways. You know, I love Shalom Aleichem, Chaim Grada, both singers, Isaac Pesheva Singer and his brother Israel Joseph Singer.
Yeah.
Some of the Russian Yiddish writers, Moshe Kulbach, and Katya Molodovsky, her poems, Rachel Korn. Oh, okay. There are so many that I've read and I feel influenced by that, again, I can't really pinpoint one. I think I've just absorbed them all and somehow, and as you know, I do quote Levick at the end of the book.
Yes.
And
yes.
Some of those poems are just so powerful.
Devastating. Just devastating. Who's your favorite character in the book?
That's difficult. Well, I think Arthur Mandelkorn. I lived with him. I feel like I know him so well. You know, he seems to just be like a constant companion. He just undergoes so much in the story, but yet finds a way to live a productive life. And I find that's what really puzzled me when I started writing this novel. How do Holocaust survivors go on to live relatively happy lives? Most people write about survivors as being so severely damaged that they can never recover. But from my experience, the survivors that I know, from what I observe, and I'm not saying that they're not damaged, but they seem to have been able to somehow carry on and learn how to love again, how to laugh again. And it was this quality that really compelled me. And I somehow, in Arthur Mandelkorn, I think I've tried to portray that.
Oh, it's fascinating. I think that's an excellent observation. It's not that there aren't damages, and there's sometimes manifest in second and third generation survivors, of course. But somehow they've not only often gone on to make a life, but to succeed tremendously, to build great families, to continue out of the ashes in this incredibly positive way, and that's lost often.
And of course, Israel plays a great role in my novel. I mean, it wasn't...
it's almost a protagonist itself, I would say.
Yes, Israel is almost like a protagonist. That's true. That Arthur finds his way by joining in the enterprise to revive the land. And, you know, that is certainly part of the puzzle.
You include some really interesting and somewhat obscure aspects of Judaism. For example, chalitza, the release of a...
Yes.
Tell us why you chose to do that.
You know, it just came to me as I was writing. I really did not plan to do that. For readers, I don't want to give away too
much.
Okay,
sorry. I don't want to ruin the book.
It is a very
odd
tradition.
Well, it's a crazy tradition in a way. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with the halachic, the Jewish legal principle of chalitza, which I would think be almost everyone, if a brother's wife dies, the other brother is theoretically obligated either to marry her or release her from that obligation.
Yeah.
And it's complicated. It doesn't even work the way it's supposed to work in the Bible sometimes. Like in the Book of Ruth, it doesn't really go the way you would expect it to go. But there's a very interesting episode that you include. It adds authenticity. A guy who says, I'm not, you know, really religious, but I want to make sure that I've released you appropriately.
Yes, exactly. I did not want to write what you'd say, a from novel.
Right.
I felt that it would be much more engaging to a broader readership to write about Jews that everyone could relate to. And so even though Arthur Mandelkorn is very drawn to Jewish tradition in many ways, and I think that comes out, he isn't an observant Jew. So, but yet he follows some of the practices like chalitza.
Well, you know, the idea of a Jew not being an observant Jew, but being very knowledgeable about Judaism and practicing aspects of Judaism was very common in Israel. Not so much for kibbutzniks necessarily, but for others and people that had come there.
Yes.
Were very, very familiar with it in earlier generations. I think that divide is broader now in Israeli society.
Yes, I think it is. Although, you know, when you go, and I've been to Israel so many times, there still is a kind of societal recognition of the life cycle events. So that, you know, a lot of Jews will have a special meal on Friday nights.
Right.
That sort of
with
thing.
With their family, whether or not they're lighting candles and making Kiddush. It's going
right,
to be
exactly.
You're with your family for Shabbat dinner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have witnessed that. And it's quite widespread.
The Toronto Jewish community that you grew up in and that you served is a very interesting community.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how that plays into the way that you approached Come Back For Me.
Yes, well, Toronto and the Toronto I grew up in was really filled with survivors because a great many of them came in the post-war period. And a lot of them came from Hungary, actually. That's part of, I have known a lot of Hungarian Jews, even though I also am not of Hungarian origin. And a lot of people say, well, why was Arthur Mandelkorn from Hungary? Are you Hungarian? I say, no, I'm not. But I know a lot of Hungarians, and they were very prevalent in Canada and Toronto, particularly at the time. So it's an unusual community because it is much less assimilated. And Jews tend to be very attached to their origins in a way that I think American Jews have, I think much more than American Jews, whose connection to their European background is much more tenuous.
What contemporary Jewish novelist do you like?
You mean really contemporary?
Yeah. Of your own contemporaries, let's say.
My own contemporaries.
I mean, now that you're a novelist, you know,
yes.
Not just a literature professor. And
who do I like to read? I like Mark Halperin, actually.
Really? He's my favorite author. I knew there was a reason I liked you.
Oh, isn't that funny? That I'm just reading Paris in the Present Tense right now.
Yeah, just, by the way, a past guest of Too Jewish, I have to add.
Pardon me, I didn't hear what you said.
I said a past guest of Too Jewish, Mark Halperin.
Oh, really?
And a fantastic novelist.
Oh, I know.
And short story writer.
Yes, absolutely. I really love his work. So I would say he's really one of my favorites.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, his writing style is very different than mine, too. He's
yes.
much more... his prose is so lush, and I tend to be much more spare.
Right.
But his sensibility, I think, is there's some kind of similarity in our sensibility.
Well, I think there's a depth to both of you, and I mean that as a compliment. There's a way
of
probing what people are really all about, not necessarily their superficial characteristics.
Yes.
Can be illustrated that way, but there's something deeper that he's always getting for. He's always reaching for something more.
Well, that's what I'm always trying to do, and I really appreciate the fact that you understood that.
The book is called Come Back For Me. Where can people go to find out more about you and about the book?
Okay. The book is available in bookstores. I don't know if American bookstores have ordered it as much as Canadian bookstores have, but it is in bookstores.
We can work. We'll work on that.
I hope so. it is available online as well. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and various other websites. And I do have a website. It's SharonHartGreen.com. So if anyone wants to know more about me or they would like to contact me, they can contact me or I have a literary agent in Boston. So they can either go through her or contact me directly.
I want to thank Sharon Hartgreen for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Best of luck with this exquisite novel, Come Back For Me.
And, thank you.
When you finish your next novel, we'll definitely have you back.
I would love to come back. It was really a great experience.
Thank you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Phil Blazer, founder of the Jewish Life Television Network, among many other accomplishments, winner of the 2017 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for Service to the Jewish People. Don't miss it. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes at our TooJewishRadio.com website as well. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish for the holiday of Hanukkah, celebrating the fifth day today and the sixth night tonight, comes from 613. Their quite ridiculous parody for Hanukkah, a tribute to dreidels called Watch Me Spin, Watch Me Dreidrei. My friends, have a Chag Hanukkah Sameach, a Chag Urim Sameach, a happy completion of this great festival of religious freedom, lights and latkes and dreidels, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shalom. You already know what holiday it is.
Hanukkah, Hanukkah, it's your boy.
Shin, don't gimbal, hey, hey.
Spin that dreidel,
I like that wick. La hard lick, nay, nay. Because that oil lasted for 8 days.
Make it lock, cause I can smell those. And sometimes it's you've got me.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.